I'm Spencer, I'm an alcoholic.
Yes,
yeah, hearing all the people from out of town, Canada, Washington, D.C., Kentucky, I want to feel like you came all the way to Utah just to hear me speak, but that's probably not true. I got sober July 20th of 2016, and when I got to AA, I did not want to be here. I was not excited about making it into AA, and I remember thinking to myself, God, how did I end up here? And if I'm sober another couple of months, it'll be 7 years. And I look around today and I thank God that I'm still here. And AA's just been amazing and given me a life that I could never have dreamed of. A little bit about my childhood. I actually grew up about 2 miles northeast of here. So I grew up in Provo, Utah. I grew up in a very healthy home. I was the 7th of 8 kids. We were religious. So here in Utah, everybody says the predominant religion, but it's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I grew up Mormon. And, we didn't have alcohol in the home, but I was aware that there was alcoholism in my family. On both sides of my family, my mom and dad's side, there was alcoholism. And so that was my childhood. I really wasn't exposed to alcohol or anything like that. One of the things I probably want to talk about for a second, this ties into the sociopath stuff. I took a personality test a few years ago for work, and it was a professionally done personality test that my work paid for. They wanted to figure out what department to put me and some other people in. I'd gone through this training program, and so I took the personality test, but they gave me a practice test to kind of get used to it. And if you've ever done a personality test, I think this may be just a me thing, but it might be an alcoholic thing. But I have like two answers I come up with when I read a question, because they're all scenario based. And so my first answer is kind of like the asshole answer, like, if somebody makes a mistake, we fire them, we do this, and it's like the really harsh answer. And then there's the second answer that kind of comes into my head, and that's the what I learned from you people here in AA, like the love and tolerance and kindness. And so I remember asking my sponsor at the time, like, I don't know how to answer this, because this is going to control what department I'm put into. It's going to control my day-to-day life. And he ended up just saying, you know what? What would you do in real life? Like, you would have the crazy answer first, and then you'd go with the AA one, and so go with that one. So I went with all of the answers were like me on my very best day, and this was my personality. So I'm a type A and I'm a type C personality. I'm very extreme in both of them, and I kind of border on both of them. And so type A are directors. We're ambitious, we're competitive, we're controlling, we're impatient, we're aggressive, and we can be a little hostile at times. And type C, we're thinkers. We're very detail-oriented, we're logical, we're prepared, we love to plan. And it gave a suggested occupation for somebody like me, and it's as a executioner. So, like Neil, you're not far off on that. But like that's the dream job, right? That's like the gold standard, because you get to do the most deplorable thing known to man, killing some. But like society cannot judge me for it, and so. Hopefully that helps you understand a little bit about how my thinking is and what it was like growing up. I do remember at a young age always being a planner. And I don't know if people know like what process mapping is or tree mapping or tree planning, but it's like I have a expected result that I want to happen. And so I map out in my mind, I need this, 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 and this to happen. And I'll say this, and if you come back with this, then I'm going to counter with this, and I'm going to control everything so that things work out exactly how I need them to work out. And, one of the downsides of that that type of thinking is that I have a really hard time staying in the moment. I'm always future tripping, or I'm thinking about the past. And so that's another thing from my childhood that I remember a lot of, was that I just never was living in the moment. I remember when I was 16 years old, I went to a high school football game, And at halftime, I went out into the parking lot and I saw some friends and they were in a car and they were drinking. They had bottles of Jägermeister. And I went up and said, hi, I smelled the alcohol, and they offered me some. And I had never been offered alcohol. I'd never been around it. And I said, yeah, sure. So they, right after I said yes, they said that they needed to go somewhere. So they filled up a red Dixie cup, one of the big ones, all the way to the top full of liquor, and then just told me to chug it and then let me loose. And so, like, that was my first drink. And, you know, I had the best night of my life up to that point. And the next day, I remember analyzing and looking at, you know, what had happened the night before. And there were a few takeaways I had. One of them was I loved alcohol. Like, I'm going to do this again. This is awesome. I did realize that it was the first time in my life that I was just like able to be myself, be in the moment, be present. And so that was, you know, I think that's, you know, the effect that I was chasing from then on out. But the other thing was too, because my friends filled up my drink and then left, they took the bottles of alcohol with them. And I remember 2 or 3 hours after I had that drink wanting more and like wishing I'd gone with them. So, you know, I could, you know, when it started tapering down, I could keep it going or, you know, get more drunk. So I decided, I'm 16 years old. I decide that I'm going to drink and party and do all this stuff throughout high school. I don't want to get in trouble as an adult because that's messy and there's problems, but I'm going to party for the next 2 years. And I'd always wanted to go on a Mormon mission. And typically you would go at 19 years old at that time. And so my plan was I will party hard until I'm 18. I will stop. And then I'll go on this mission at 19. And, you know, I set out, and basically I was drunk or high every single day, you know, for the next 5 or 6 years. I didn't stop in 2 years. but, you know, for me, I absolutely love drugs. I'm, you know, I'm one of those people that I'm like one of those equal opportunity users. If you've got it, I'll take it. And, you know, and so that was my partying. And the truth was is that I ended up stopping at about 22 years old, and there had been talks of rehab and detoxes, and I've been arrested, I've had DUIs. Like, I'd gotten a ton of trouble for a few years, and finally I stopped by just basically white-knuckling it. I got a job that kept me really busy. I spent a lot of time with my family. I had to change my phone number like 10 times because I'd cut off all ties with old acquaintances. And I just white-knuckled it so that I could go on this LDS mission. And I was extremely depressed at the time. Like, I was really suicidal. But my thought was, like, if I can just make it onto this church mission, everything will be okay. My life's going to be okay. And, you know, I went on a church mission. I went to Tampa, Florida, Spanish-speaking. And, you know, it was awesome. I followed the rules. I worked really hard, like for 2 years. It was just an awesome experience. And what you're doing all day is you're doing service and you're teaching people about a higher power. And, you know, I think that's a lot of what we do in here. And, you know, I really didn't think about alcohol for 2 years. Like, I got some relief from my alcoholism. But when I got done with my mission, I came home and started planning again and scheming, and, you know, picked up right where I left off. And I've always had, I mean, it talks about I'm very ambitious, I'm competitive. So my vision of what my future would look like was that I need to be rich. And like my expectations of what rich was is like so unrealistic. But, you know, I needed to be successful and important. I wanted to have a family. Like, I wanted to have, you know, a trophy wife, which I got, you know. And but what ends up happening is, like, I end up getting married within a year of being home from my mission. I'm working, and my wife, she had our daughter is not my biological daughter. And I knew, you know, marrying my wife, like, I knew that I was meant to be this little girl's father and she was meant to be my daughter. Like, you know, I firmly believe that. But I was an instant father, and there was a lot of fears and stress there. You know, one of the things, too, is that there was a lot of fear for me because I wanted to adopt her, but there was some legal stuff we needed to go through. And, you know, if anything happened to my wife, I didn't know that our family would stay together. And so that was a little bit of a scary thing for me. The other thing is I did get a job. I had always wanted to do financial planning, retirement planning, investments. That's what my dad did growing up. And so I actually went and worked with my dad, and I had gotten some licensing and had gone to school, and I was doing retirement planning. The tough thing about that line of work is that my dad says every single day you wake up unemployed. You know, you got to go out there and find business and find people to invest money with you, which that sounds stressful. I don't really like that, you know, but I was doing it, and I was really good at analyzing investments and presenting plans to people. But it's really tough because I'm in my mid-20s, and a lot of the people I'm talking to are in their 50s, 60s. They've got a lot of money, and they really don't want to listen to a 20-something-year-old kid tell them what to do with hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I had this idea that if I fake it till you make it, right? So I'm going to spend my money on suits and ties and a nice car, and if it looks like I'm doing well, you might think that other people trust me with their money, so you'll trust me with yours, and we'll, you know, we'll get a lot of business coming in. You know, it worked out okay, I guess. I don't know. I did do okay in the beginning, but as stress and anxiety started to kind of come in, I wanted to find a cure for that, and I went back to something that worked for me, and that was alcohol. And you know, I remember I had a plan that I'm just going to do it this one weekend, right? Just once. We'll be okay. And then it went so well that I did it the next weekend. And that went so well that I started doing it every day. And, you know, before I knew it, I was off. I was back where I was just a few years earlier. And, you know, part of the culture of being Mormon was that it wasn't normal for me to have alcohol on my breath. Like, I can't be just rolling around like, oh, we had a few extra at lunch or, you know, brunch or whatever. Like, that wasn't normal. And so I took pills, and my sponsor says I need to be authentic and not call it sedatives, because, you know, Bob D, you know, he did sedatives during the day to maintain and then drink at night. And so that's, you know, I was taking a lot of Xanax. Xanax is basically alcohol in pill form. And so I would take that during the day, and then I would drink at night, and I loved mixing them together, you know. And so I was doing that, but I'm buying this stuff off the street. It's starting to get expensive. I'm doing the fake it till you make it thing as well. So, like, I'm pretty strapped on cash, and I wanted to be fiscally responsible. So I turned to the country of India. For my solution. So I would order in bulk, you know, a bunch of different pills from India. I'd have them shipped to a P.O. box so my wife wouldn't find out about it. And I'd take these things. And, you know, like over-the-counter medications that come in the aluminum sheets or whatever that you pop the pill out, I would get those. And, like, with these pills, I could take five of them and I'd feel amazing. And then, like, the next day from the same sheet, I would take another five, and I'm not feeling anything. So I take another five, and, like, I'm not feeling anything, but I've got a stomach ache, and I'm pissed. And then there was the other time where, like, I'd take two of these things, and I'm, like, paralyzed on the ground, like, unable to communicate, you know? And so, and truthfully, like, if I have my choice between the five or the two, like, I would take the paralyzed on the ground. Like, that was more my speed. The issue that I had, though, was that my wife, she would plan activities for, like, our family to go on. You know, we're going to go see the tulips at Thanksgiving Point, or we're going to go to a park, go on a hike. And so I would pop these before we'd get in the car. And sometimes we'd get there and I'm happy. Sometimes we'd get there and I'm pissed because my 10 aren't working. And other times we wouldn't get there. You know, she would have to steer the car to the side of the road and take the wheel and you know, drive us home, and she's crying. And you know, there was a lot of times where I put my wife, my kids in tons of danger, and just everybody on the road. And so, you know, the cat's starting to come out of the bag. I've got a problem, and my wife's confronted me a few times about it, and what ends up happening is that I'll tell her that I'm going to try to do better, I'm trying to stop, whatever. The truth was I wanted to manage, so for about a year I would tell her I'm trying to stop, but I'm really just looking to manage. And so at night when I drink, I would I draw a line on the alcohol bottle with a Sharpie, and that was like my stopping point. And so the next day, I remember one time I woke up and I had like a horrible headache, and I look in the mirror and I'm bleeding and I've got a black eye, and I kind of remember what happened. I'd walked into the corner of a door and I like face planted onto the tile, and just it's a mess. I'm not looking good, but I went and checked my alcohol bottle and I was within 1 inch of my line, my stop line. And so I felt like it was successful. Like I can, you know, like I controlled this. And so, you know, that's the insanity, but it got worse and it got worse, and I got to the point where I was really trying to actually stop. I wanted to stop altogether, and I just couldn't. And you know, there was one incident in particular that life had, and things had gotten so bad. I hadn't been working. We're in a massive amount of debt. Our house is up for sale. My wife had to take a catering job, so she would work at night until 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I'm not trusted to take care of my kids, so my mom would watch my kids. But at 10 o'clock at night, she's got to go to bed, so she brings my kids home. I need to watch them from 10 to 3 in the morning. And my daughter goes to sleep because she's a little bit older and you know, whatever. But my son, he's 1 year old, and he will not go to sleep, and he just is crying. And as much as I want to say it's a fussy baby, the truth was I was a complete stranger to him. You know, I had been isolated, locked in a room, getting drunk for about a year now, and I would hold him, and he just cries. And I'm not an idiot. It's not my first baby. I know how to change diapers. I know how to feed him. I know how to burp him and rock him, and I can't get him to stop. And that's when I kind of knew that, like, I was powerless over alcohol, because I had alcohol. I could go get drunk if I wanted to and remove myself from the stress, but I knew if I took one drink that what would happen is my wife would come home to a blacked out husband and a baby that's unattended crying, you know? And so I just sat there, and for 5 hours, I just cried with him. And the minute my wife got home, I handed the baby off and I locked myself in the room and got blackout drunk. And, you know, that's what it had come to. And during that time, depression was a huge thing. You know, I thought about suicide a lot. I also didn't want to leave my wife and kids, you know, without a husband and father. And so the idea of murder suicide seemed like a really good idea a lot of the time, you know, and it was just a miserable existence. About 2 weeks after that, we had a family dinner, and we show up an hour late. I'm running red lights on the way over, passing out. We get to dinner, and it's at my parents' house. I've got a huge family. I've got nieces and nephews and a bunch of people there, and I'm nodding off, and I face plant into the mashed potatoes, and like, it, you know, it was bad. And so they clean me up. They drag me over to the couch, and they, you know, I think my nieces and nephews are like, "What's wrong with Uncle Spencer?" And you know, but the next day there was I got intervened, you know, and my parents came over and they said, it's not safe for you to live with your wife and kids. So you can get help or get out, but you know, you can't be here. And so I went to treatment, and I go to treatment, and I signed up to do 90 days in treatment, and I get there and I'm pretty foggy and things, you know, I was on the spin dry. I was not thinking real clearly, but I felt really unique, and I felt like I didn't belong there. And I remember getting to know some of the other residents, and there was a lady, Nancy, that she would drink perfume and hand sanitizer and mouthwash, and like that was low class, you know. I was like, she's a freak, you know. But and then there was, you know, there were like you know, druggy, junky people that had been injecting into their neck and they've got scars. And so I do not fit in. I'm high class. And so my family comes to the treatment center like after like the mandatory 2-week waiting period, and they show up and I got a plan. I'm presenting them like, hey, I really only need to do 30 days. You know, I'm not like these other freaks in here, and I don't have a problem like them. And you know, my family didn't buy it. They said, no, you're doing the 90. And I went through all the stages of grief. But I ended up just kind of deciding that I'm going to make the most of this. And so I got myself a sponsor. Let me get a little drink real quick. So I got myself a sponsor. This guy had 38 years sober. He would go to a lot of the meetings that the rehab would go to. And you know, he was just solid. He was really patient with me, but he would come to the treatment center. We would read there, but he would also give me things to read during the week. He'd give me writing assignments, and we start going through the steps. And, you know, I did put an honest effort into the steps, but looking back now, my step 1, 2, and 3 were kind of BS. My step 1 was basically, you know, I'm powerless, my life's unmanageable. Well, yeah, I'm in a freaking rehab, so what do you think? Like, I get it, you know. And step 2, I really banked on the fact that I had been a Mormon missionary. I'm like, yeah, me and God are good. I'm all right. He'll cure me of this. And let's move on to 3. And 3 was, you know, I'm turning my will and life over to the care of God. And yeah, I'm doing step work with you here, so let's keep it going. And so we get to the 4th step. And I love the way that he did the 4th step with me. Essentially what he said was, he's like, all right, I want you to make a shit list. This is basically anybody that's wronged you or done anything, harmed you in any way, shape, or form. And this can be people, this can be a business, it could be a religion, ideas, like whatever. I want you to just write down everybody that's wronged you. Now, I didn't read ahead. I didn't know that there's like other columns. So this was like I was making my case for like Spencer's a victim here, right? And I went to town and I made a huge list. And then he tells me the second column was like, all right, well, what happened? What'd they do? So I went to town on that. And then what did it affect? Well, it affected everything. So I went to town on that. And then we got to the 4th one and it was like, well, what's your part in it? And I'm like, at the time, I was really only capable of probably 10% honesty. So I put that 10% on there, but we got together and we did the 5th step. And he just leveled me. He completely leveled me and went through each point and was like, no, you know, here's where you're wrong here. And it's much more than that. And, you know, a good example of this was there was this woman that I absolutely hated. And She was my friend's mom when I was a senior in high school. He was a good kid. I wasn't. I'm over there at his house hanging out with him, and there's a bunch of high school kids there. The mom comes down, hey, Spencer, nice to see you. She's really, you know, friendly and nice. And then she asks her son, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? Takes him upstairs, and basically we can hear through the vents. Everyone can hear, and she's like, what are you doing bringing him in my house? Get him out of here, and whatever. So, like, I was embarrassed and offended and hurt, and I used that for years. Anytime I was lonely, I looked at her, and I was like, you know, that woman, I would have more friends if it weren't for her, and, you know. But I hated her so much that, like, even about 2 years before I got sober, she had a son that died. And I remember when I heard about it, and I said, good. Like, maybe now she'll feel some pain, you know. And that's the way I felt about this woman. And my sponsor, what I wrote down was that, you know what, I carried this around, or I blamed her for my problems. And he helped me to see that, you know, this woman was a good woman. Like, what would you do if your kids were hanging out with someone like you? And I'm like, well, I'd kick the little bastard out of the house. Like, I'd drag him out myself. The truth is that she was a really good mom. She does a ton of service in the community. She's a great woman. And not only did I see what my part was, but I could see her value and that she was a good person. And that's how a lot of the people on my list, that's how the fifth step went. And I basically, you know, if I can just sum it up, I left that room that day feeling at peace with the world. I was right size. I wasn't better than or less than anybody. I could see my place in the world, and I was happy, and I was okay with it, and I had hope. And so, and the other thing too is that he had us do like the sixth and seventh step right then and there. We knelt down, we prayed. This sponsor, he'd have us hold hands when we prayed. I thought it was a little like weird or, you know, whatever. But the truth was, is like, he took it really seriously. And when we knelt down and prayed, it meant something. At the time, you know, my 90 days are up. So I'm getting out of treatment. And this sponsor, he always said, I'm your temporary sponsor. So when you get out of here, you got to go get yourself a sponsor where you live. So I get out, and there's a lot of pressure because at the time, my wife, we had to sell our house. She had to move everything out of our house into a storage unit by herself. And then she was living in my parents' basement with our two kids. So I get out and move into my mommy and daddy's basement. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure that I felt like that I got to get everything back. You know, I need to get everything back immediately, and I need to work on that. But I had a lot of fear about relapse. And so one of the things that was a huge blessing was that before I went to treatment, when I decided I was going to treatment, I cut a deal because I had a DUI. And so I cut a deal with the judge that if I do 90 days in treatment, they'll reduce some things down and I'll, you know, be okay. Well, my lawyer said, all right, go tell the judge, you know, about your work and the steps. You got a sponsor, you go to five meetings a week, all this stuff. So I told that to the judge, and he said, that's great, Mr. Robinson. I'm going to order you to do that for another year. And so I had to do five meetings a week for a whole nother year beyond that. And, you know, that really saved me because it helped me focus on what was most important at the time. And so I told my wife, hey, I just really feel like I need to get my feet on the ground and get myself level, and I need to focus on recovery. And so she was working during the day. I got a job working at Home Depot at nighttime, just stocking shelves. And, you know, I would go to five meetings a week. I would get a little bit of sleep. I'd sometimes take my kids with me to the meeting because I had to, and I'd watch my kids and she'd work. And we just kind of started getting this routine. So I'm going to meetings, but I haven't gotten the sponsor. I want to find the perfect sponsor. And so I took my time on that. And the thing that I realized then is that, you know, meetings are not the program. The meetings are where we go to encourage each other, motivate each other, inspire each other to work the steps. But it's not the program. The step work is the program. And so what ends up happening to me is I start to have insanity come back into my life. And, you know, I'm poor, very poor. I don't have a driver's license, and I'm not trusted with any money, even if I had it. So I can't go get drunk. I can't go get alcohol anywhere. So the hand sanitizer and the mouthwash starts looking really delicious, you know? And I remember being in rooms and thinking like, go grab that bottle of hand sanitizer and go to the bathroom. Like, and my mind would race on it. Like I would just, if I'm in a room and that stuff's in there, or thinking like, you can just go up to the upstairs bathroom, there's mouthwash there. Like that insanity came back, but I knew I couldn't drink, and I didn't really want to drink that stuff, but I would have. But you know, the insanity came back. I knew what's going to happen if I drink. I'll get back into that cycle of alcoholism. And so hanging myself sounded like a really good idea. And I remember, you know, I would just fantasize about suicide all day long. When I'd go to a meeting, I'd get some relief. I wasn't suicidal or wanting a drink when I was in a meeting, but I'd leave the meeting and it was right back on. I got to kill myself. And my parents, you know, they had locked up all the guns, and pretty much anything that'd make it easy to kill myself is like not accessible to me. And so they had this pole in their storage room. And I remember I'd like jump up on it and hang from it because I didn't want to like fail at suicide because like I've already failed at everything and it would be embarrassing. So I would like scope out and like figure out I'm going to do this. And one day I went to a meeting and I left and the insanity came back and I said, you know what, screw this. I'm going to go do it. I'm going to go kill myself. I'm done. And, you know, at the time, you know, I went home and I'm starting to make preparations. I had a little bit of a window where nobody was going to be home. And the thought came to me from How It Works. When we read How It Works and the part where it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And I got honest with myself and I hadn't given myself to this simple program, you know? And so I wasn't fully committed, but I was like, all right, I'm going to test God out on this one. And there was this guy that had given me his phone number at a meeting a couple months earlier. And I said, I'm going to call this guy up. And if he answers, then I'll work the steps. But if he doesn't, I'm hanging myself. And, you know, I love this guy, but he didn't always answer on the first try. And it was like, he told me what he was doing later on. And it was God. You know, God got him to pick up that phone. And so he answered, and I just went through with everything and just said, listen, my wife hates me, my kids hate me, everybody hates me, you know, I want to kill myself, I want to drink, like, my life is just a complete mess, and I, you know, haven't been working the steps, and, you know, I'm crying and whatever. And he relayed some similar stories that happened to him when he was early on in sobriety. And at the end of it, I just said, listen, like, I need help. I need to work the steps. Will you sponsor me? And he agreed. And so we dove into step work. And, you know, one of the funny things about it is that I learned so much from this man. One of the things was when we got together to do step work for the first time, I really didn't even know if there was a God. I didn't know which way was up. But like I really was not firm on any sort of higher power or God or whatever. And so I go to this guy's house and he has us kneel down and he has us say a prayer before we start the step work. Now, I don't want to slander him because I don't remember what he said, but I know he swore in the prayer. And it was like something like, you know, please help Spencer to pull his head out of his ass, or, you know, it was something like that. And like, we did the step work, and then when I'm going home, I'm like, this guy's a psychopath. Like, I'm not, you know, I was judging him, and then the thought came to me, and this is kind of how my higher power works for me, is, you know, I get communicated through very clear, piercing thoughts, and the thought came to me, you know what, he's got a higher power. You know, he talks to his higher power, you don't. And so, you know, I realized that there was a lot I could learn from him, and you know, at that point, I just had to take my previous knowledge of a higher power and whittle it down to the most simple form. And I probably didn't feel really worthy to pray or you know, pray how I had prayed growing up. And so I got really into the recited prayers. You know, the Serenity Prayer, I'd say it all day long. And third step prayer, seventh step prayer, even the 11th step prayer. And so, you know, that was something that I would do that, and then I would tack on my own little stuff at the end. So I'd do the Serenity Prayer, and I'd be like, all right, please bless me not to snap at my coworkers or, you know, whatever. And that's how it was for about a year and a half for me. I mean, I started from scratch with a higher power there. The other thing, too, that this sponsor really taught me was just how to improve my relationships with everyone around me. We really focused on the sixth and seventh step. And, you know, one of the things I love is the phrase, you know, God does for us what we can't do for ourselves, but also God will not do for us what we can do for ourselves. And in my case, there were a lot of times where my wife would be saying something to me and I would just have to shut my mouth. And I want to get this right. Pull the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth. That's what I had to do. I get it backwards sometimes, but you know, so that's what I did. And I love this sponsor because he had a great relationship with his wife and his kids. And a lot of his advice to me was like, shut up, she's right, you're wrong. You know, if she gives you a suggestion on something you need to improve on, you tell her, all right, let me work on it, and then you bring it to me and we'll work on it. And that's what we did. And one of the cool things too is that we started getting into the ninth step and making amends. And, you know, one of the things that he taught me was that every amends has a living amends tied to it. You know, a lot of times we'll sit there and say, oh, it's a financial amends, or it's a, you know, written amends, I got to write a letter to somebody, or it's an in-person amends. But it was like, yeah, we do that, but every single one of them has a living amends with it. You know, I got to be a better person today. I want to be a better person. I want to be the husband that my wife deserves, the neighbor my neighbor deserves, you know, the employee that my employer deserves. Whatever it is, I want to be better and treat these people better than I have in the past, because my best thinking ends up, you know, with me getting drunk and wanting to kill myself. And so, you know, that was a period, you know, for about a year and a half. I was just trying to, you know, keep my head above water and improve my relationship and work the steps and do the best I can. And, you know, one of the things too that this sponsor really focused on was he had certain requirements. You know, one of them was that I had to get a home group. I had to get a service commitment in that home group. I needed to read 2 pages out of the Big Book every day. He'd also have me read Upon Awakening in the morning and When We Retire at night. And I remember when we got to like the 10th and 11th step, and I was like, all right, what are we doing? He's like, you've already been doing it. You read this, you do this. And so, you know, he was showing me through action and teaching me along the way through actions how to work this program and how to work these steps. And the other thing that really helped was that he would tell me, you have to talk to another alcoholic on the phone every single day. And it can be me as your sponsor, but if I don't answer, you're not off the hook. You got to call somebody. And so about that time, I had kind of my backup person that I'd always call. And so that was Neil who introduced me. Neil was kind of my backup. And, you know, I would... second string. Yeah, you're Neil's an all-star. But, you know, I got to the point where there were a lot of opportunities in my life, a lot of things going good, but there were also still some areas where I just felt like I needed to grow more, and I felt like at about 2.5 years sober that I needed to dive into the steps further. You know, I need to go deeper. And, you know, so I went to my sponsor and I said, hey, you know, I feel like we need to go through again. And he said, honestly, the best thing you can do is go through with somebody else and get another perspective. And so I asked Neil to sponsor me, and, you know, we went through a lot deeper into the steps. One of the things that Neil talks about a lot is like emotional sobriety. And I'll stop using his name, anonymity. But, you know, we talk about emotional sobriety and, you know, doing inventories throughout the day, like the spot check inventory. And so, you know, I'm making phone calls to him at the end of the day, and it's like, okay, how did you do today? Well, I you know, was short with this person, and I was feeling this way, and I felt this, and really just tracking what's going on with me emotionally, because the problem that I was having is that for a really long time, I kind of leaned on the selfishness and self-centeredness, right? Anytime I was feeling off or not right about something, it was, hey, Spencer, you're selfish and self-centered. Go do some service. Go do something else. But the same things keep popping up. And I wanted to figure out, you know, what's really underneath it. And in my opinion, a lot of the time when that happens to me, it's that there's fears. You know, I have fears that you know, things aren't going to work out the way I want them to. And I get irritated. And then I try to just push them down away by saying it's selfishness and self-centeredness. And so we dove deeper into the fears and did inventories on that. And, you know, a lot of really intense stuff came up, and you know, we went into the financial inventory too. Financial inventory is something that I typically don't do that with sponsees their first time through, maybe a little bit, but you know, for me, when I really looked at the way I spend money, if I'm bored or depressed, I will, like, I need new shoes, I need a new golf club, you know. But at the same time too, I will throw money at a problem if I don't want to deal with it. If my kid's being a little snot and wants me to buy a toy, rather than like teach them good principles of about, you know, patience or work, hard work or whatever, I'll just throw money at it so he'll shut up, you know. And that's the thing, is that that's okay. I'm not, you know, I do it, but at the same time, there was a lot of things with that that I realized, you know, I'm uncomfortable having serious conversations with people. I'm uncomfortable giving people bad news. And there was a resentment that happened at my work where for a really long time, you know, my character defects, you know, when we talked about the personality stuff, you know, personalities don't make me an alcoholic. But what alcoholism does to my character traits is it turns them into character defects. And for me, you know, I had stuff at work where I was uncomfortable in a situation, or I had ego or pride, and so I would become a pushover. I was a people pleaser, and I found myself where I was going above and beyond, and I liked the reputation I was getting at work. And then when they didn't give me the money I felt I deserved, I had a resentment against everybody in the organization, you know. And so I did this step work with the sponsor, and what I realized is that I had taken control of my character defects. Rather than, you know, telling God, hey, I want you to manage my ambition and my competitiveness, I just did the opposite of it. You know, and that's not me turning them over to God. That's me taking control of them and just doing the opposite. And what ended up happening to me is just more pain. And so, you know, going through the steps a little bit deeper, it was a huge blessing to me. One of the things that ended up happening with it, and I got to kind of catch up where I'm at. So my daughter, it was a big fear of mine that something would happen to my wife and my daughter would be taken from me. And I'm the only father that this little girl's ever known. I'd wanted to adopt her for a really long time, and there were some legal problems because the birth father was in Florida and he was not involved and didn't want anything to do with the situation. But the Florida laws were very, very favoring to the father. And in Utah, they're very favoring to the mother. And there was a lot of fear that if we initiate this, are we going to have to do a shared thing? What if he fights it? What if, you know, this and that. And I had, you know, the process mapping. I'm going to map out every possible scenario here, and I'm going to control this. I had done that for years. And so what ends up happening is I'm about 4 years sober at the time, and my wife and I had spent quite a bit of money on a lawyer, and we just really weren't getting anywhere, and we didn't feel confident with it. And we had taken probably a 6 to 9 month break from talking about it. We're just not going to deal with it now. And I remember there was a man in AA who was a lawyer, and I talked to him after a meeting, and he knew me pretty well, and he knew my situation. And I just said to him, you know, hey, this is what's going on. What do you think about it? And I wanted him to give me his legal opinion for free, basically. And he didn't give me that. He said, it sounds like you've got a God problem. It sounds like you've got an issue trusting God on this one. Like, why don't you pray, figure out if it's the right thing to do, and figure out if it's the right time to do it. And whatever your answer is, move forward with that. And I went home from the meeting, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm gonna talk to my wife about this. And I got home and she says, I think we need to hire this lawyer. She was already, you know, two steps ahead spiritually. But she said, I think we need to hire this one lawyer. And so we did, and it was done within 2 months, you know, without a hitch. And that's just a perfect example of, I mean, my biggest problem and the problem that I've had my entire life has been trusting somebody else, especially a higher power, you know. And I cannot deal with the feeling that things are not going to work out or that I can't control it. And so that's why I drink or I want to kill myself. And the truth is today is that, you know, that's my alcoholism. My alcoholism is not my drinking problem, right? My alcoholism is all of these personality traits and fears and issues that I have that alcohol became a solution to me for so many years. You know, one of the things too is that today my relationships are completely different. My wife, about four years ago, she got involved in Al-Anon. I secretly wanted her to go to Al-Anon, but I didn't, because you always have this fear as an alcoholic that they're going to like drop the hammer on you and get strict or something. And the truth is that, you know, she works her program, she's got her sponsor, I have my program and my sponsor, but we live by the same design for living. We follow the steps, and, you know, our relationship through me making amends, I think we've probably had 5 or 6 really long conversations where I've had to make amends for things, or she's made amends to me for things. And, you know, our family today, early on, my kids, they would come to the meetings with me, and I put headphones on them, so they're earmuffs, so if you want to drop the F-bomb or the C-word or whatever, you can probably do you could probably do that. My little son Spencer, he had a speech impediment or speech issues, and like one of the first words he was saying was the F-word. I blamed you people, but you know, the truth is like today my kids beg me to go to a meeting, you know, because they've met my sponsees, my sponsor, the people in the rooms, and they've seen the difference it's made in our family. You know, AA has fixed and you know, all of these broken relationships and given me a life that I could never have dreamed of. And you know, today I don't work at Home Depot anymore. Like I went back to school and I got a job that, and by the way, Home Depot, that was like my favorite job because I was driving forklifts and stuff. But, you know, I have a job today that I'm passionate about, that I'm good at, that allows me to take care of my family and allows me to be actively involved in AA. And, you know, if you had asked me, you know, 10 years ago what, you know, if what I look like today is a definition of success, I would have been like, no, he's a loser or whatever. The truth is like, I have more than enough today. I have a very full life and I enjoy what I do. And one of the biggest blessings that I have is, you know, the opportunity to sponsor men in the program. I didn't sponsor my first person till I was about 3 years sober. And I was trying hard to like, present myself, and I was giving my number to people. I mean, I've gone on dates, I've asked girls out, and I'm not shy, and I was basically taking that same approach with these guys after the meeting, like, hey, take my number, call me. And you know, for a really long time, people, you know, maybe they didn't want what I had, but the truth is like I've had sponsees that have, you know, relapsed. I've had sponsees where we've gone all the way through the steps and they decided they don't need AA anymore, you know. And then I have other ones that, you know, they're doing the deal today. They're going to meetings. They're actively involved. They're carrying the message. They have sponsees of their own, you know. And I can see the miracle in my life. It's sometimes a little hard to see the miracle that's taken place. But when I look around, it's a lot easier for me to see the miracle in the people in these rooms and the people around me. And, you know, I've been extremely blessed to be a part of AA. And I'm one of those weirdo people today that's like grateful to be an alcoholic, you know, because me and left to my own devices, you know, I could never have gotten this type of life. And, you know, one thing I just want to close with is got to find this. So in the big book, I don't even know if it's a chapter, the spiritual experience, is it a chapter or an appendix? So the spiritual experience, the first paragraph in it talks and it says, the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. And, you know, for me, I didn't have a spiritual experience. It was slow process. It was a spiritual awakening. But the truth is that, you know, I have a difficult personality. I'm probably a sociopath, Neil, right? But, you know, the stuff that I drank over years earlier, I don't need to drink over it today. You know, I'm here so that I can change and I can grow, and, you know, that I can not only not drink, that I can be sober, but that I can be a better human being and learn and grow. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that opportunity. So, you know, I'm really grateful to be here and to be sober, and I'll take another 24.